How did you vote on
I'd like to call the local government meeting to order February 2nd. I'm Representative Mark Olson. Welcome.
All right. Welcome.
I believe we'll have a quorum in a little bit. And the agenda today, there are three bills, House File 210, House File 416, and House File 159. In that order, Representative Blaine, do you come forward? Welcome to the committee. I understand you have two people to testify.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Blaine, do you have somebody that's going to move your bill? Representative Blaine, I'll move your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And it needs to, refresh me, this one needs to go, I'm ahead of myself here today.
I'm going to go to the General Register, Mr. Chair.
I understand it needs to go to Transportation Finance.
Okay.
So I will move that House File 210 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Transportation Finance. Representative Blaine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, for the record, Representative Greg Blaine. I represent District 12B, most of Morrison, part of Crow Wing County in central Minnesota. Mr. Chair and members, it's good to be back in the hearing room for the Local Government Committee, where I had a great time serving on this committee the past 2 years. And I'm back here now with a piece of legislation that I've carried now. I think this is the third time I've carried this bill, and it's never been stopped in a committee yet, but always seems to be used in the kind of in the end game as a bargaining chip. Members, House File 210 is a bill that deals with reimbursement for local units of government for providing fire services. It's kind of been known as the car fire bill. I'll go through the bill probably relatively quickly, and then I have David Fricke here from Minnesota Association of Townships, if members have any questions with this. And also we have the fire chief from Vadnais Heights here today too, who would like to speak to the bill too. So members, if you look through the bill, section one of the bill requires the Commission of Transportation to reimburse a municipal or volunteer fire department for ordinary expenses incurred extinguishing car fires within a trunk highway or interstate right-of-way if the fire department is not reimbursed from another source. The reimbursements are permitted up to $300 per fire call, and this establishes a motor vehicle fire revolving account in the general fund. To bring this, to probably put this in most simplistic terms for members who maybe have not seen this bill before or understand this bill, the problem that we have is we have people who we have car fires, local units of government, and the fire departments are called to extinguish these fires. The owners may not have insurance or may not be there to pay for those services. The problem with this is then the local unit of government, township and their township fire department end up eating this cost, and these costs can add up over time. I'm coming before you just to bring a vehicle forward that will reimburse local units of government and the fire departments, and this revenue comes into this fund from the responsible party by assessing their property taxes, and that's how the revenue flows through this. Mr. Chair and committee members, if it's all right at this time, I'd have Mr. Fricke from the Minnesota Association of Townships take a seat at the table, and if there are any other questions, any questions on this bill, we'd be more than happy to answer them.
Thank you, Representative Blaine. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Fricke. If you'd state your name for the record, please.
Fricke, and Executive Director for the Minnesota Association of Townships, and thank you for this opportunity. Once again, the local government committee, that we've had this bill go through the Senate and through that all the committees in the House previously, and I think Representative Blaine has it down pat. He said pretty much everything we have in here, and I don't know if any of you heard the other day, there were some comments being made about how many people, because of the system change on the cards for driver's insurance, that how many people in Minnesota that have driver's license don't have driver's insurance, and it's a pretty substantial amount. And I think that as you hear from the cities too, this is really an opportunity to start something to... It's not a huge amount, but it would recover some of those losses that we have when we send our fire departments and EMTs and that out to a scene on a trunk highway or on the interstate highway system. And would once again appreciate your help on passing.
Mr.
Chair,
I'm sorry. Any questions,
Mr. Chair?
Representative Pimar.
Just trying to get a sense of how big this problem is. I mean, you represent the township, so what's the average cost to a township of money that's not captured for putting out a car fire? I mean, what's like an annual financial problem that a township might experience that would warrant legislation?
The city might, Mr. Chairman, the cities might be able to give you a little better perspective from just the, you know, their own community in terms of how many calls that they're called out on that they don't recover damages. And how, you know, sometimes it's one piece of equipment for a car fire, and sometimes it's multiple pieces. So we don't have any calculation really on how much is lost, but this is just a kind of an administrative help to all of our fire departments. Most of our townships contract with the cities. We have about 30 township fire departments, and so a lot of this comes out of both of our budgets when we're paying the bills to people that don't pay for these car fires.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask Representative Blaine then, does the League of Cities have any research to tell the committee this kind of problem we're experiencing out there? Why this is a... I guess I don't see too many car fires, so I'm just wondering...
Mr. Chair, thank you, and Representative Pimar, when we had this bill heard last year, we had a number of individuals who had come forward, and I didn't bring those some of these same people here with this bill this time around, but if you have a township, let's say in a northern county of the state on the interstate there, and they have 4 or 5 car fires a year there, and are not reimbursed on 2 or 3 of those, the cost of the township, which they should be, in my estimation, should be reimbursed for their services, you know, may approach $1,000. And so for when you look at a local unit of government like a township that does not have great revenue base to begin with, as far as the amount of money to work with, $1,000 to them can be a substantial amount of money. Representative Pimar, I think if I would bring our other testifier here from the city of Vadnais Heights, or fire chief here from the city of Vadnais Heights, he may shed a little more light on this from their perspective, and I think that you would probably find that interesting. So, Mr. Chair, if it would be all right with you, I would like to bring him forward too.
Okay, Representative Lane.
Chairman.
Excuse me, a question from Representative Cornish?
While he's coming up and getting ready, I just wanted to thank you for your bill here. You beat me to it.
My fire department approached me about this and very same thing, and not getting reimbursed. In certain areas of the state, got a lot more car fires than others for some reason, especially in the grassy regions, like where I was up north, and a lot of non-reimbursed costs, and they're operating on a shoestring budget anyway, and so I can see a real need for this.
Thank you, Representative Cornish. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, please, and you may proceed.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Ed Lear. I am the fire chief for the city of Vadnais Heights. I provided the committee a handout based on the statistics I ran over the last 10 years. As you can see, the city of Vadnais Heights protects 7.5 miles of Interstate 694 and 35E. That's just 7 miles. We responded that pattern of traffic there is 130,000 cars a day, projected to go to over 200,000 cars a day in the next 10 years. In the last 10 years, the city of Vadnais Heights has responded to calls on that interstate for grass fires, vehicle fires, and to crash rescue or accident with injury calls. And you can see we've responded to 17 grass fires, 53 vehicle fires, but 470 calls for assist with extrication or potential fires that are not credited as a fire. The city's average costs, our operating costs, not our capital costs, are $350 per hour, and that's a rough average depending on the amount of people on the engine, but it does include training, turnout gear, and the operating costs. City of Vadnais Heights receives no state aid or any tax dollars or deferred costs for protection of this real estate. In closing, the city of Vadnais Heights supports 210, but we'd like you to look at addressing also crash rescue calls to be refunded out of the same pool instead of just fires and grass fires. And this bill has been around for a long time. I talked to a legislative representative from the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs Association, and they have a long history of supporting this bill also.
Any questions? Representative Paymar, any follow-up?
Nope.
Any other questions for Mr. Lear? Mr. Lear, one comment I'd have, kind of a question. Am I understanding that the merit of this proposal is really tied to the fact that there's a real disparity as far as what fire departments have to, the needs that fire departments have to meet with various areas of the state? Quite profound what you reference with regard to the interstate going through the area, the flow of traffic, and the amount of calls you have as it compares to others, and that's kind of a related to an out of jurisdictional area. It's a cause related to needs based on people coming from outside your jurisdiction, and these fire departments are traditionally meant to provide the needs of the people within the district.
Exactly. Fire departments have been established to protect life and property within the community. Okay. Now with the interstates being constructed the way that we have, a large transient population is taking a lot of our business, that there is no tax base for us to recover our costs. If we go to a house fire or a fire on a residential street, that generally is a resident of our community. Out there on the freeway, they are not. And sometimes they're not even residents of the state, but we're still providing the same level of service. And if you look at the event that happened last night, the more vehicles and the bigger they are, the safer our employees are going to be. And that's, some of them are sending extra trucks out there just to act as barricades so we can create a safe zone. So it's probably two engines that are going out there now instead of one. But again, back to your question, there are no tax dollars to provide this level of service out there on the freeway.
Thank you, Mr. Lair. Seeing no other questions, Representative Blaine, any other comments?
Mr. Chair, just I guess at this time I'd also like to thank one of your committee members, Representative Scalzi, for helping to bring Mr. Lair here to testify on behalf of this bill. And I know Representative Scalzi and other members of your committee have been very interested in this bill and its passage, and so I appreciate the time that the committee would take to hear this bill and look forward to its passage.
Thank you, Representative Blaine. All those who testified. Any other testimony for or against this bill? House File 210. Seeing none and seeing no questions, I will renew my motion that House File 10 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Transportation Finance Committee. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the same sign. The motion prevails and the bill will be moved to the Transportation Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members,
I'm sorry, Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to publicly thank the Fire Chief of Vadnais Heights and to Representative Blaine for bringing this forward, and thanks to those who took the time out of their busy day to come to visit our committee. We're very appreciative of that.
Thank you. I'll call Representative Larson to the table for House File 416, and while he's coming and getting ready, I'm trying to see who has been attentively reading the minutes this morning or this afternoon. Representative Garofalo.
I'd be happy to move the minutes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Representative Garofalo moves the minutes from January 31st, 2005, that they be approved as submitted by the committee administrator. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Thank you, Representative Greffel. Representative Larson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's a pleasure to be back to the Local Government Committee as a former member of this committee. And here to, well, perhaps, Mr. Chair, if I could get someone to move House File 416. Unless you've heard otherwise, I would imagine this could go to the floor.
It's my understanding we need to go to transportation policy.
Oh, okay.
And Representative Peterson?
I'll move the bill.
Okay, Representative Peterson moves that House File 416 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Transportation Policy Committee. The bill is before us. Representative Larson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 416 is a very straightforward proposal that would very simply require that appointments to the Metropolitan Council and to the Metropolitan Airports Commission have the same qualifications that are required of legislators as it relates to residency. And basically, the current law says that a council member, a Met Council member or MAC commissioner, only needs to reside in the district in which they're appointed to represent. This merely says that the member or the appointee has to have lived in the district that they're to represent for 6 months and to live in the state for a year. A reasonable standard, I believe. Just briefly to give you some background, this legislation comes to us as a result of a recent appointment made to the Metropolitan Airports Commission to represent the community that I represent. My goal today is not to have a debate about that appointment. Given the circumstances, the individual that was appointed has not met these requirements, and it's sort of been our history and our tradition, I think, that at the MAC and the Metropolitan Council, that we have community leaders. I know that we have at least two former Metropolitan Council members with us on this committee. Representative Peterson served our area, Bloomington and Richfield, on the Metropolitan Council and did a great job, as well as did Representative Frank Hornstein. And so it's our goal that we sort of preserve that tradition and we provide some framework for that, and that's what House File 416 does, and I'd appreciate your support. Stand for questions.
Any questions?
I'm sorry.
Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Larson. I don't think the bill as written does what you want it to do. Because you haven't tied the residency of 6 months to the time of appointment, as far as I can tell, I think I'd qualify for being appointed to represent Minneapolis, given that I lived in Minneapolis for 10 years and in the state for at least 6 months. Not that I would want to infringe any territory here, but I think you have to tie the 6-month residency to either the time of the appointments being posted or filled or whatever.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbert, you've raised a question and a point that had not thought about. It was certainly the intent. What you've described was the intent of the law. And so perhaps we have a drafting issue that we need to resolve. I don't know if that's something that is easily done. Perhaps counsel can help us.
Ms. LeFevre.
Mr. Chairman, members, perhaps we could change the wording on line 14 of page 1 to provide must reside in and have resided in the council district represented for at least 6 months and in the state for at least 1 year. Prior to appointment,
Mr. Chair and
Representative Holbert.
Time of appointment.
I think that gets to half the problem, but if it is the author's intent that 6 months be contiguous to the time of appointment, I think you have to show the relationship between that time frame. If you
perhaps, Mr. Chair, and Representative Holbert, perhaps prior to appointment. Immediately prior to appointment language would work better.
Ms. LeFevre.
Mr. Chairman, members, let me try again. If we had that sentence read beginning on line 13, each council member other than the chair must reside in and have resided in the council district represented for at least 6 months and in the state for at least 1 year immediately prior to appointment. Would that seem to cover?
Representative Holbert.
You're getting closer. Just so that the "and" immediately prior to appointment modifies both halves of that sentence.
Uh-huh.
And that's probably an English teacher's decision, not mine.
Further comments?
Oh.
Ms. LeFevre?
I'm getting some assistance from my colleagues. How about if we make a sentence begin, at the time of appointment, each council member other than the chair must reside in and have resided in the council district represented for at least 6 months and in the state for at least 1 year. That do it?
I think we're there.
Representative Holbert, thank you. Good wordsmithing here.
Good job.
Ms. LeFevre, if you could restate that amendment so we have that one stated twice, everybody knows that's it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, members, now on page 1, beginning on line 13, prior to each, the sentence would begin, at the time of appointment, comma, each council member other than the chair must reside in and have resided in the council district represented for at least 6 months and in the state for at least 1 year. And then there would be additional changes on page 2. Beginning at line 6, it would be essentially the same thing. At the time of appointment, comma, each council member must reside in and have resided in the council district represented for at least 6 months and in the state for at least 1 year.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Groppel.
Am I hearing this wrong? Did we lose the immediately preceding phrase? Mr.
Chairman, members, I think that we did lose the immediately because we've added the at the time of appointment.
Right.
Prior to the.
That's correct.
And there would be a third place where the same, essentially the same. This would be page 3, beginning on line 33. At the time of appointment, each member shall be and have been a resident of the district represented for at least 6 months and of the state for at least 1 year.
Further questions, Representative Groffel?
Oh.
Representative Hornstein?
No, thanks. Oh, Representative Holbert is clarifying it for
okay.
me.
Okay. Representative Hillstrom, to the amendment.
Mr. Chair, it's on another issue, not the amendment.
Okay. All right. To the amendment, questions. Representative Wardlaw.
Thank you. I'm still not convinced that does the trick because at the time of the appointment, I do have a history of 6 months living in the city 2 years ago, maybe.
Representative Wardlaw, are you a math teacher?
But my mom was an English teacher.
Just kidding, of course.
Thanks. Being algebra has logic in it. Yeah.
Miss Lefebvre.
It's a good question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hornstein.
I think that I probably should still ask this question.
Okay.
On page 4 of the bill, section 4 application, it talks about the act applies to the counties, you know, the metro counties, but aren't MAC commissioners also, there's several MAC commissioners that are, you know, from Duluth, and it's really a statewide pool that they draw from. So I was wondering if how that would affect those lines. I don't know if council has a thought on that or...
Mr. Chair?
Rep. Semple-Berg.
Given this bill is going to go to another committee and committee time is valuable, maybe we can, we know what his intent is. We know that we have some wordsmithing cleaning up to do. Maybe that could be done in the intervening time between here and transportation policy, of which many members of this committee are also a member of, and might allow staff to work out some of the kinks and move forward.
This is our area of jurisdiction. It's up to the committee members. I have a concern with it that I need to bring up too, but I'll wait. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This actually does go to my point. My question was going to be, why exactly does it have to go to transportation policy? I wasn't certain which piece in the bill would require this to go.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, she's looking at me. I'm not the chair of transportation policy. I don't have a clue why this would be going to transportation policy, but it may be because it involves MAC and MAC's underneath transportation policy. That would be a question you'd have to bring up with Chair Earhart.
I'm told that it has to do with the MAC, and because it does, they want to see it.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Larson,
you know, if Chair Earhart wants to see this, I have no problem with that. That's fine. I'm a member of that committee, and at least to my knowledge, he doesn't have a problem with the bill, so that should be okay.
Okay. Well,
Mark.
I see some more language coming, maybe. While that's being worked on, Representative Larson, for time's sake, I had understood that we were going to look at this for the after the next election. Were you planning on making a change to the enactment date?
I know that, Mr. Chair, we did talk about that, and I'm comfortable doing that. I know that the council does have an amendment that I'm comfortable with. If the committee prefers to not essentially change the rules on this governor, that's fine with me. I'm fine with it being effective today forward, but if it makes the members of the committee more comfortable, I certainly would not oppose that.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Peters?
Dan, I'd like to ask that he would consider putting an amendment date on this for enactment so that it is not seen as in any way trying to embarrass the existing appointment. We're not trying in any way to put a name wrapped around this, and it would probably be better if this did have an enactment date down the road so that we can defuse any accusation that it is specific to persons. And I'd ask the author if he would consider doing that.
Yeah, I'm again, Mr. Chair and Representative Peterson, I don't have any problem with that at all. And the amendment is there. If a member moved that, I wouldn't oppose that. Again, this is not, it is not my purpose to do anything but to sort of better the process, if you will, so that none of us face this situation in the future. Again, it's not my goal to bring to the legislature debate about whether or not an appointment ought to be made. The governor has wide latitude in making MAC and Met Council appointments, and you know, there are a lot of proposals that would change that latitude quite a bit. This, frankly, does very little to do that. It's just a little protection. So I would have no problem with a later effective date.
And, thank you.
We have an amendment.
Representative Markford.
Mr. Chair, in light of those comments from Representative Larson, I would move to make this effective a date that would begin with the next governor's term, which would be January something of 2007. And I don't, council has an amendment. So I'd move that we amend page 4, line 31, and delete the day following final enactment and insert January 1st, 2007. So I'll move the H.O. 416A1 amendment.
Thank you, Representative Marquardt and Representative Larson. We are supposed to have these here 24 hours before, but if there's no objection, we'll take this. It seems that we have agreement, wanting to be sensitive to that. The amendment A1 has been moved by Representative Marquardt, being handed out. I think it's pretty straightforward. Is there any questions or discussions to that amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the Marquardt motion to amend House File 416 signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted to change the date to January 1, 2007. Do we have additional language?
Mr. Chairman, I think we do.
Okay.
Let's try it on...
Ms. Lefebvre.
This would be... Okay. In each of the three places, we would change the wording from what's currently drafted to begin on... This would be on page 2, line 6. At the time of appointment, each council member must reside in the council district represented and must have resided in the council district for at least 6 months and in the state for at least 1 year immediately prior preceding the appointment.
Does everybody have that? I think the intent is clear and it sounds more accurate.
Mr. Chairman, I'll get it printed up so that the committee LA can have that.
Okay. Representative Wardlaw.
Does that mean the whole year has to be immediately prior to the appointment or just 6 months of it? And then another part of the year could have been elsewhere.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wardlaw, I think that that would be both the immediately preceding 6 months in the district and the immediately preceding 1 year in the state. That would modify both of those terms.
Representative Holbrook, do you have any...
Oh.
Okay. I'll entertain a motion to move that amendment.
So moved.
Representative Holbrook moves the amendment as stated. Any further discussion to the amendment? Representative Anderson.
Could we have it read one more time, please?
Yes, we can. Ms. Lefebvre.
Mr. Chairman, members, it would read... At the time of appointment, each council member must reside in the council district represented and must have resided in the council district for at least 6 months and in the state for at least 1 year immediately preceding the appointment.
Any questions? Any objections to the... On the basis of the 24-hour rule, we'll waive that again. We did put in the rules at the discretion of the committee, and I just want to remind members. We're doing good work today, being very thorough.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd just like to thank the committee for working with me, especially Representative Holberg, who's helped to rewrite my bill. I've had bills rewritten in committee previously, but they weren't nearly this much fun. And actually were much more harmful to my bill. So this really improves my bill, and I appreciate that.
We're giving you a track record of writing bills in committee. Is that it, Representative Larson?
Send a set of precedents for your
okay.
session, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any further discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, Representative Holberg renews her motion to amend House File 416 as stated by Ms. Lefebvre. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, same sign. The motion... prevails, the amendment is adopted. Any further discussion to the bill as amended? Representative Laney.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we still have an unanswered question here with regard to the applicability to those representatives that come from outside of the metropolitan area. And I think we need to get that clarified in here as well.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Larson.
And Representative Lanning, that certainly is a legitimate issue, and it was my intent when I brought this legislation forward that we deal with the areas that are split into districts if, in fact, it's the desire of legislators from greater Minnesota to also have a residency requirement. I don't have an objection to that. It just wasn't my original issue. Certainly look to council if in terms of current applicability. But
any other comments? Representative Lennon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was not suggesting that there be a residency requirement for those outside of the metropolitan area. I just want us to be clear here that if they're not to be affected by this, then we need to make that clear. Or if they are to be affected in some way, we need to also clarify that.
Ms. Dyson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Lanning and others, I'm not sure if I have a comment. I thought the question had to do with the application clause at the end of the bill. Was that the question of why is that there?
Yes.
That is, you will see that on metropolitan government-related bills because it, under the state constitution, the provisions relating to special legislation relating to local government, there is a requirement that if the law applies in one or more counties, that you name the counties in which they apply, in which the law applies. Although the Metropolitan Council and the MAC are political subdivisions of the state, and that's the unit of government, as a drafting matter since the mid-80s, the convention has been to put in this application clause to meet that constitutional requirement that you name the counties in which the unit of government affected by the legislation is located. Now, if the question has to do with the residency requirement and the representatives of the MAC from greater Minnesota, that's a different question, and I won't speak to that, but I just wanted to respond if the question had to do with that application clause and why we list the seven counties in the metro area in legislation relating to local to the Metropolitan Council and the MAC and metro agencies. It's almost like a boilerplate provision to meet a constitutional requirement on legislation relating to local governments.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I take that then to mean that this bill as it currently stands would not apply to the out-state members. That the current policy remains the same. The current appointment policy remains the same.
Is that Ms. LeFevre or Ms. Dyson?
Mr. Chairman, that is my understanding.
Okay. That is correct.
Thank you.
Any other questions to the bill as amended? Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Grapple.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the Representative Larson or any committee member, do the lines for the Metropolitan Airports Commission districts change at all?
Representative Larson.
They do change with reapportionment, yes, Representative Grapple, Mr. Chair. Through a redistricting process that we're all familiar with in terms of a population, and that occurs, I believe, every 10 years, like our census and redistricting legislatively occurs.
Mr. Representative Grapple.
The concern I have is that I know with the redistricting last year in my area down in Farmington, the governor was elected, we appointed people to the Met Council, and then immediately there was a redistricting process that had taken place. And actually, my district, someone was appointed, we went through that process just 2 months later, and then we made these new appointments. And you know, as an exurban area, which is rapidly developing, these lines probably affect us more than anyone else in the metro area. And under that situation, it could affect an appointment, or we could actually lose someone who wanted to stay on the council. Again, that would probably have much more ramifications to the Met Council than the MAC. That's a concern I have.
Representative Larson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grapple, I think that I think there is a separate issue there, and I think that is a challenge that is that administrations have faced as it relates to redistricting. And I know that and I know that communities find that, I think, somewhat frustrating. This doesn't really address that, the issue there's no probably easy way to align that process with the change of an administration. And that's the problem, is that presumably it's the Constitution that requires us to have districts that are even in terms of population, and I don't have a good answer to that, and I certainly am not setting out to resolve that with this bill. This bill just merely means that if you're going to be eligible for an appointment, you'll have some history, somewhat limited, I'll admit, certainly in Minnesota, but then within the district that you're to represent. And you would under a redistricted district because you're living in that new district.
Mr. Representative Groff, I'm not trying to beat a dead horse here, but the situation I'm concerned about is that the governor would appoint someone to a commission, they would redistrict, and now this person really was interested in serving on the Met Council, now wanted to move to a district maybe just a couple blocks away to continue their service in the Met Council. This legislation would prohibit that.
Representative Larson. Representative Garofalo. Yeah, you're right, it would. Okay. And I guess we're providing some protections for communities, and perhaps that's one consequence to it, that someone wouldn't be able to move to be on the Met Council. But
I'm sorry. Representative Lencheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Garofalo. Listening to your question, I was thinking to myself, yes, it would do that, and it should. And what I would say, I'm just kind of watching your thought process on that, while these people are not, they don't run for office, they are, the governor's appointees, it's similar to all of us. I mean, if we get redistricted out by a couple blocks, too bad. You either pick up and move and be in there 6 months before, or you don't run for office in a place you don't live. So I think that's exactly what the legislation is trying to get at, that the people who these Met Council representatives like Representative Peterson and Representative Hornstein have been, that they actually reside in the community they represent. So I think it corrects a problem that no one had thought of before until it happened. So, I would hope you'd consider supporting it. And I will admit, for truth in advertising, that I and Representative Peterson and Representative Larson and Representative Earhart share that common district that was affected. And I want to thank Representative Larson for letting that go and not trying to go backward and not trying to get involved with that appointment and the governor's intention and just saying, going forward, let's put it in place to make sure that any of us who reside in the metro who have a representative on the Met Council of the MAC would actually know that whoever is working for us and for the governor actually reside in those districts and don't move into them just to be there.
Any other questions, comments? Representative Larson, given the nature of our amendments on the fly, I just appeal to you to consider any members' concerns they might bring forward after the meeting. I appreciate members' patience in flexibility in considering these amendments. I personally prefer that we have our issues from this committee addressed before we move a bill out, if at all possible. So I appreciate members' patience on that. If there's no further discussion, any additional testimony for or against the bill? Seeing none. Representative Peterson renews his motion.
I do.
That House File 416 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Transportation Policy Committee. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, the same sign.
No.
Motion prevails. The bill is passed as amended and will be re-referred to the Transportation Policy Committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair and members.
I do not see Phyllis Kahn or Representative.
Yeah, I got that right here.
I don't see Phyllis Kahn or Representative Krinke in the committee room. And I understand there's some concerns with the bill, so it appears to me that there's no intention of bringing that up today. I see no motion.
Mr. Chair, maybe we should let our staff just make sure that this is a courtesy to Representative Kahn if she really did intend to be here.
Thank you, Representative Paymar. We can certainly do that. We have an additional item that I've stated at the last hearing that we would have to discuss today.
determine that has to do with the hearing of the local government aid, the TIF bills, and the sales local government sales tax option bills. The input that I've received has been pretty much, in fact, I haven't had anybody say that we shouldn't hear these bills. I haven't had a lot of input, and with that, I'll just entertain any thoughts. It's not my intention. We have to spend a lot of time on this, but I stated in the beginning I wanted to facilitate as much as possible our making decisions on these kinds of things as a committee. Since we have some minutes here, we can take some time to discuss it. It was my intention to just make sure there's an opportunity for members to move one way or the other. We don't have to have a motion. Given the tradition and precedent in this process that's long been there now, I can certainly just decide that, but I'm wanting to make sure there are no objections. Any thoughts from committee members?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Liston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When I first got on the local government committee, we did hear all the TIF bills, but it was just simply passed through. We heard the policy. We really didn't kill any of the TIF bills. We left that to the tax committee. And so my question to you would be, in the event we did hear them, would your intention be to hear them and pass them on, or would you expect that we would be killing some of these TIF bills in this committee?
Representative Hillstrom, I'm one member of this committee, and I don't have the authority to kill anything. But if I do, bring me North Star Commuter Rail and bring me the stadium.
The stadium will have it
up. Just kidding, of course. as I stated in the last meeting, I very much understand and would agree with the concerns that Representative Lencheski raised, and it was even suggested to me that was pointed out to me that when these were heard in the past, they were generally heard on a day where you try to hear them all and move them through. It's up to this committee whether or not we vote to pass them with or without recommendations, or we vote to defeat them. I don't have intentions other than what I stated earlier to facilitate good discussion, good debate, proper amendments, and if you want my personal intentions, I stated those. But as far as the committee goes, that's not my agenda. As much as possible, I want to facilitate good discussion. Any other thoughts? Representative Cornish.
Personally, I'm not looking for more work. I got enough. I see no advantage in bringing a bill in. We're not going to either kill or send on, one of the two. And I don't really care how it was done 20 years ago. As pertaining to now, I just don't want the extra burden of passing through another committee. I think the system's working fine now, so, for what it's worth.
Thank you, Representative Cornish. Representative Holbert.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. I think we did have this discussion. Maybe I wasn't clear. I think it is really kind of a waste of time. What I think about is these constituents that go through the trouble of getting their Sunday best on and drive all the way down here and make the presentation. They make all these beautiful boards. They run off 30 copies of full-color information, and then if we're just passing without recommendation or moving them on to the tax committee, it's really unfair to make them go through that whole thing and then have to come back and do it again in front of the tax committee. And I was here when we did hear them, and I was also here when we didn't hear them. And if the committee has lots of time, we want to do it fine, but also consider these poor people that drive 3-4 hours each way to come down here to do this, and if we're not going to have any meaningful action on their proposal, I think it's unfair to them.
Representative Holberg, given your comments, if I may, I just want to clarify my response to Representative Hillstrom, and I can't speak for all of you, but I don't feel that we should simply facilitate a dog and pony show, for lack of a better way to put it. I personally think that we do have some jurisdiction over them, and there are some policy issues that we should consider. And I think we should be looking at them like any other bill that we have jurisdiction over, that has issues in it that we have jurisdiction over. And if it was done that way, where it's just a process and they're all moved through, I would question that. I hope we don't look at it that way. I personally feel that we could do this, but it's entirely up to the committee. If a member wants to make a motion to make it hard and fast what our positions are, we'll listen to a vote. I need some sense. I don't want to belabor the point. Your discussion is good, but I want to emphasize that if we hear them, I think we should hear them like any other bill. And if we vote them up, we vote them up. If we vote them down, we vote them down. But it's not my intent to bring them all here and kill them. I think we have some jurisdictional issues that should be considered, and maybe not in all of them, because of the uniqueness of their requests. Oftentimes, they're getting exemptions from policies that... let me ask, is a regular TIF bill that just changes TIF policy, is that not brought to our committee?
No.
No? Representative Renchesky.
Thank you, Chairman Olson. I would think if you're going to pursue TIF bills, it would have to be fair. In general, we haven't seen those general purpose TIF bills come here in the past, but I would think if you want to look at the matter seriously, then I would argue that you should do those as well. I've carried a number of pieces of those legislation myself, personally, and I guess one of the concerns I have with the process, whether it's TIF or local sales tax options, is in general, and Representative Marquardt and Representative Lanning can chime in on this and share their view on this, because they serve on the tax committee as well. In particular, the TIF legislation is very boring for the majority of legislators. My opinion, and Representative Lanning and I have served on the TIF working group, which the past tax chair for 6 years didn't even have the whole tax committee deal with it. He had a small group of legislators deal with it and make recommendations. And he had found legislators who actually were intrigued, and I will admit I'm one of those people, by TIF. Now, most legislators find it incredibly boring, as I've stated. And therefore, I think what we found in the tax committee is you get real disinterested legislators just kind of voting on, not on the merits of the bill, but just kind of on whose bill is that. And the move in the tax committee over the last 6 years has been to take a small group of legislators who actually care about the intricacies of legislation as it relates to tax increment financing and have them look at them author blind. You know, no Democrats, Republicans, no metro, rural, just is this a good bill? Make a recommendation to the full tax committee, and that part becomes part of the full a portion of the public finance bill that goes to the tax committee. So I do think there are a lot of legislators here who might be really interested or might think they're really interested, and then when they actually get into the structuring of particular parcels, they might find it not that interesting. So I guess I'm just saying it's just something to think about. I always enjoy hearing them, so I'm not a good person to ask there. But in general, you know, the committee should know that all local sales tax option bills and TIF bills, if they're heard here, are going to go to taxes too. I mean, they can't constitutionally not, so they're going to get there. So I don't know how Representative Lanning feels about it, because he's actually worked on that TIF group, and I don't know.
Representative Pimar was next.
Mr. Chair, I've not been on this committee, nor have I been on the tax committee, so I'm not sure what we'd be getting into. But, from a policy perspective, I mean, tax increment financing has been an interest for me for when I was a city council member, as well as being a legislator, because, as I've said before here, I think that there's great misuse of tax increment financing, including by my own city, and it's a reality of it, and someone should be looking at it. And we have the state auditor here who says that she has no oversight over any of the aspects of the law relative to the but-for test and other aspects of tax increment financing. And so who's looking out, you know, for the public's best interest? I mean, we have cities, we have school districts and counties that are hurting because of tax increment financing districts. Now, I said to say that some of them aren't warranted, and they clean up blight, and they're good for cities. I don't disagree with the concept of it, but they have been misused in the state of Minnesota. And it seems to me someone, if it's not the tax committee, then this committee or some other subcommittee should be looking at the efficacy of proposals that are brought to the legislature. But then again, I don't know how much work is involved in all that.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate very much comments of Representative Holberg and Representative Renchesky on this issue. Representative Holberg. I appreciate the sensitivity to those of us and our constituents that have to travel a long ways. And I guess that if we're, one thing we should definitely not do is just pass through, have things pass through here. And I agree with you, Mr. Chairman, with regard to that. I think there's a real serious question as to whether we need thorough review by two committees, and to not only put those of us who may serve on both committees through that twice, but also I have concern about staff. I know how much staff time was involved in the last session with regard to these issues, and to put the staff through that much work and activity for two committees, to have two committees thoroughly go through these bills, I think is overdoing it. Now, I guess I have a question, Mr. Chairman. Isn't it true that we could, as a committee, you could, as chair, if there was to come forward a bill that had some statewide policy implications, that you could ask that that bill come through here, that we wouldn't necessarily have to hear all of the TIF bills, most of which are, as Representative Lanchesky said, boring individual community-type bills, but we could request, I believe, that a bill come through this committee if we felt that there were some important statewide policy implications.
Representative Lanning, that's a very good point. I could do that. Any one of you could do that based on the way we've tried to structure our decision-making on these matters in this committee. Any one of you could do that. More eyes on this are better. And that's one of the reasons I believe in what I've put forth for our process. Yes, we can do that. In fact, that's what I was identifying when I was recognizing we need to look at these bills. Some of them may pass, some of them may not. Some of them should pass, a lot of them should pass, some of them may not. I don't think we should look at it based on whether or not it's boring. But with all due respect, we need to make a decision. I'll entertain a motion. I see that when one community in a metropolitan area where there's numerous communities that makes a decision to push for a local government sales tax option, I think it has merit to bring it here and discuss to address concerns of neighboring communities and have that debate. That's one of the reasons. That's a simple reason why I think there's merit to hear some of these bills. We could be selective. I think it would be good to have one day where we really focus on this issue. That being said, it's the committee's decision. For that reason, I don't want to make the motion that we hear them. I'd like to hear a motion that we not hear them or that we hear them. Representative Markworth.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would move the Lanning proposal, or what he said. And that was to hear TIF bills that would have statewide implication and not hear those that would be just local, and those would go straight to the tax committee. Representative Lanning, is that kind of what I, you know, there's a number of us that would hear those bills twice, and like what Representative Holberg says, and bringing people up. I think there are some, you know, the stadium bill that might have implications and so forth. There are other statewide type things, but anyway, I'll try to paraphrase what Representative Lanning said. Put that in the form of a motion.
I think that's pretty clear. Anybody have any questions on that? With that, I would like to... Representative Lanchesky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Maybe I can answer it, Representative Lanchesky. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, and I think both Representative Lanning and Representative Markworth know that I have incredible respect for both of them, and if you all don't know this, they are some of the brightest members of the Minnesota Legislature and work diligently on the tax committee. They also know that... when we think about it just parochially, there are those bills that are local and state. But going over here to Representative Tamar, what I would say is Representative Lanning and Mark Horton know this as well, is every tax TIF bill has a statewide implication in the sense that it takes state resources from the entire state to do TIF districts no matter where they're done. Because the state steps in, and it used to really incredibly cost so much money because it paid for the school portion that was taken off the tax roll. Since the 2001 tax reform, that's no longer taking place, but the county resources are picked up by the state of Minnesota. So when any of you do a TIF district, you are costing the entire state of Minnesota something. So there is always some statewide cost
to doing TIF, and I think that's where Representative Paymar is going. And when we had the representation here by, or the presentation by Mr. Michael, he showed you how we are getting close to $500 million a year in state costs for TIF. And now we're dropping back down, but that is a statewide.
Representative Lencheski, part of this committee's jurisdiction is really not pertaining to cost. Our emphasis needs to be on policy. So if I'm not mistaken, Representative Lanning, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you're talking about statewide policy implications, not fiscal implications.
Right.
Okay. With that clarification.
Mr. Chairman, we're not a finance committee, right?
That's right.
However,
Representative Lencheski.
May I add the local sales tax options? Now, that's part of this, too, we're talking about. Those really do have, and it's, they are statewide effects because they administratively affect our whole sales tax and how we implement the sales tax across the state and how many jurisdictions and then how much the Department of Revenue has to administer. So I'm fine with personally hearing them all. I don't mind hearing them twice. I'm just saying that they do get detailed and they do get long, and I would just hope members wouldn't play politics with them, because it's really easy to do. It's really easy to say, I'm going to vote for this person's TIF bill or sales tax thing because they're the chair of X and I want my bill heard. And I would just ask the committee to just not do that, because a lot of these bills are awful and they're only here because people feel they need to do them because their mayor asked them. And sometimes they're brilliant. And I know, Chairman Olson, that you have really set the standard, that you're trying to take politics out of this committee, and I really appreciate it. And I have been impressed as to now how TIF in particular has had the politics removed, and I am fearful that the politics would come back into it. But I admit I have the bias in that I think we're doing too much TIF, and I, like Representative Paymar, think we should be doing less. So I bring that bias to the table.
With that, we need to make a decision. Representative Marquardt, you want to restate your...
I'll move that in regards to policy, that those TIF projects that have statewide implication would be heard by this local government committee and all others would be straight on the tax committee.
Can, before we vote, Representative Marquardt, can I ask that if you mean by that, that all of us here who see bills that have statewide implications can tell Mary Cummins here, our committee administrator, or myself, that we need to hear a bill. And we will consider that and bring it forward. And with that, we will be watching and we'll look for those bills. And if we see some we feel should be brought forward, we'll do that. And through that whole process, everybody has an opportunity to object. I didn't want this process so we can't make decisions. I want this process so we can make decisions, but we're all a part of that as much as time permits. Is that...
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay.
What you said.
With that understanding, we all have responsibilities. All those in favor of the Marquardt...
We've got some questions.
Excuse me. Representative?
Very quick, Mr. Chair. I'm assuming that these TIF bills, should we support this motion, would also fall under the criteria of the ranking system that you've set up. Is that correct?
That is correct, Representative Hornstein. The only reason, some members have asked this, the only reason we haven't used the ranking system yet is we don't have enough hearing requests on bills to warrant it. So far, we've been able to hear every, been able to schedule every bill that has a hearing request. Representative Lencheski.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry to say something, but that's exactly my concern, Representative Hornstein. I think it's unfair to rank these. If Representative Moorhead wants us, Representative Lanning wants
us, he cares for it.
Lanning wants a sales tax in Moorhead, why would we rank that? Maybe, no, not him, but you know what, Representative Samuelson, we'll hear yours. I have a huge problem with that. That's exactly what I'm saying. We either hear them all or we don't hear them.
Representative
That's how
Lencheski.
I feel about it, because these are local projects. And I would just hate to see us start voting like that, that we deem Mary Liz Holberg more important than Gene Poppy.
Representative Lencheski, how could there be more politics by taking the decision out of my hands?
I think there actually can. I mean, it's now everybody's going to, it's 23 members are going to get lobbied to vote for, Representative Garofalo's
TIF thing on the ranking so we can hear about what he needs or whatever. So,
but that's true with every local bill. And if what you're saying is true, but Representative Lincheski, then the process that I've introduced and everyone has agreed to try, then is a more politicized process than what we had. Because that's true about every local bill that comes before this committee, and there will be a few of them that do. We need to make a decision.
Can I just add, in TIF, are you also including stadium bills, which are not property tax TIF bills, they are income tax TIF bills?
That's a good question. We're talking about local government aid, sales tax options, and TIF.
So stadium bills go with that.
I had understood the stadium bill be coming here anyway.
No.
Mr. Chairman?
We had Representative Hosh first, if I may, Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. From my understanding of the motion, I didn't have the understanding that we're going to be dealing with local sales tax bills. I mean, if there was a bill that affected the statewide process of how, you know, a local option sales tax may be administered, that would come to this committee. But I definitely agree with Representative Lincheski that we need to take the local, you know, bills out that are going to succumb to politics and just deal with the statewide implications and the policy issues that Representative Marquardt, I believe, made a motion on.
Yeah.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me take one other run at this. I don't think we as a committee want to follow a practice of hearing all of these bills. It's not a good use of our time, or resources, and it's not necessary in my view. I could live with hearing none of these, but I am sensitive to the point that Representative Paymar and others make about there are certain issues that are some pretty significant statewide policy implications. And take the sales tax, for example. I would not want us to hear every local sales tax bill that comes up here. But if somebody brings us a bill saying that any city over the size of 5,000 or whatever can implement a local sales tax, that is probably a bill that should be heard by this committee, because that has serious statewide policy implications. So bottom line of what I'm saying is I think there's a reason for being selective. I would not want to see us hear all of these. I could live with none, but being selective that where there clearly is a statewide policy implication, such as the example I gave, I could live with that.
Hopefully we have some clarity. I don't want members to become discouraged with this process. I'm trying to make sure everybody has a voice. And with that, I'm going to ask that we vote. Representative Cornish, I'm going to ask that we vote. I think I know what you're going to say anyway. Begging your pardon?
I just think you're opening Pandora's box. Just from the discussion here, I mean, in the local sales tax option, I mean, that's not even local. I mean, Mankato to make a local sales tax option affects the whole region because everybody goes in there. So then we could broaden it here, that too, and we're just...
Thank you for your comments, Representative Cornish. With that, I'll renew... Representative Marquardt renews his motion to basically give the committee discretion.
Right.
And all those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, same sign.
No.
The motion prevails.
Wow.
No division being.
I'd like to see. Division.
Division? Did you attack my hearing?
Yeah.
Division being called. All those favor the Marquardt motion signify by raising your hand.
I guess your hearing was right.
Somebody better tell my wife. You get him? The ayes have it. 13. You don't get to vote, no?
Thank you for your indulgences. Representative Kahn, House Ball 159. Apologize for that delay. I was going to tell you before that I was playing with filibustering that last decision just to give you time to get here, but you got it some time ago, and I didn't mean to do that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it sounds as if you use your time very well. It was a very interesting committee decision to listen to. And since I remember you, one of the first committees you served on was mine, you've learned your lessons well. Mr. Chairman, and I'm going to, partially the limited time, mainly my fault, is I'm not going to ask for the bill to be moved today, but I would, and I'll take my chances with the ranking system and the priorities from then on. But I guarantee, though, this bill will not be boring. But I will at least like to put out my intention. I don't, do you want to, do what process do you want? Do you want the bill moved so you can have it for you?
I will move your bill for consideration to be laid over, to put back on the list, maintaining its hearing request, basically.
Okay, great.
So you can present the bill today, but we'll be laying this over for further consideration.
This bill, there are some pieces that you have in your handouts that I would like you to look at. I'm obviously not going to read them to you. One was an editorial from the Star and Tribune on what Minneapolis is doing with pensions and the issue of bonding with pensions, of which the first two paragraphs, I think, are the most important thing. The other thing that I put before you is a House research memo on state bonding and what state bonding requirements are for. And the genesis of this bill was when I discovered a couple of years ago when they started doing that the city of Minneapolis intended to bond for pension payments. And most people that I tell this to are just absolutely shocked. They had no idea that a city could do that. And so I actually came up with several schemes of doing things with pension bills that they wouldn't have to have done it, all of which the city has rejected. And, I hope we'd have enough time to have at least the city make some comments. Let me make some, and again, I didn't look at what you're required. One of the reasons I'd like the bill held over is I'm sure I haven't met your time limits for extensive amendments. And the one thing I absolutely intend to do with the bill is take out the second section, which deals, and I'll point out that that wasn't as harsh as some people thought. All it said was that we'll have a bill before us the next session so that we'll discuss this issue. It didn't do it. People somehow thought I was repealing all local bonding authority without it. But I will just, there's no need to do that. Any member can do that in the next session. And so my intention would be to strike Section 2 completely. So anyone who is concerned about Section 2 doesn't have to be concerned about it. After discussion, and I don't know if you'd want this as an, I guess it could be a submitted amendment, I might also, this was to stop it as of this summer, 2005, I might change that to January or August. I might change that 6 months or a year or something to give a little bit more warning. But, Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I would like to have Larry Martin from the Pension Commission to say at least a few words as to how this section came into state law. Because the one thing I was pretty sure was I had never seen it or heard of it. And we'll also suggest a possible path should this bill decide to go on about where it should go. So if I could have Larry Martin say something, and then...
You're just fine.
You want to stop exactly at 2...
2:15.
250. Oh, okay. Because then the other, it might also be good to have the city of Minneapolis, who's asked to testify, put their cards on the table, too. If those two could happen.
Representative Kahn, we had you scheduled for today. You have the rest of the meeting time.
Okay.
For your testimony.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
If any of you newer members do not know Larry Martin, he is an incredible source of wisdom on pension issues.
Yes. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Martin.
Yes, members. Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'm Larry Martin from the staff of the Legislative Commission on Pensions. I'm here to as a resource. I'm not appearing as the proponent or an opponent of the bill, and the bill is purely within your jurisdiction as a local government matter. What I'm here to do is to give you some insight, perhaps, as I understand, as I can reconstruct the history of how pensions, which I deal with, and bonding for pension obligations got into Minnesota statutes. And with that, I will stop unless there are questions. This piece of the underlying bill, Section 475.58, Subdivision 1, in an earlier provision in Chapter 475, permitting the bonding for public pension liabilities, sometimes referred to as pension obligation bonds, first came into Minnesota statutes in the first special session in 1985. At that time, the piece of legislation did structure the pension obligation bonds to a greater extent than current Minnesota statutes does. It did require that the proceeds of the pension obligation bonds be invested in one or more insurance policies or insurance annuity contracts to pay all or a specified part of the liability of the pension fund within the period required by law, which I construe to mean the amortization period that's set in Minnesota Statutes Chapter 356 for that particular public pension plan. That requirement that the investment be in insurance annuities or contracts and that the length of time for the bonds was done away with in Section 475.52, Subdivision 6, in 1995. It's my understanding from looking at the records of the Pension Commission from 1985 that this provision was not heard by the Pension Commission at that time, doesn't represent a recommendation of the Pension Commission, and that no public pension plan was pursuing pension bonding options in 1985. That the use in Minnesota of this provision has been by the City of Minneapolis and some consideration by the Minneapolis Teachers Pension Fund and potentially Special School District Number 1. And that's the extent of its use. Mr. Chair, I would be happy to answer questions about my testimony and the history of this provision as I understand it.
Any questions for Mr. Martin? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Martin, good to have you at committee. Haven't seen you for a while. Just your overall view of this bill as it's proposed here. Any things that strike you as advantageous or beneficial or disadvantageous for pensions?
The Pension Commission has not been appointed for this session. Obviously, has not taken any position on this. I'm their staff resource person. My personal opinions really don't make any difference. From a purely pension standpoint, having money in a pension fund is better than not having money in a pension fund. So if the money comes by way of bond proceeds or other contributions, from the pension standpoint, the ultimate recipient, providing money rather than the hope for the money is always better. I think what's at stake or what's at issue in this bill before you is the process by which a governmental subdivision that wants to bond for its pension liabilities undertakes that task. And for that, that's purely within your domain and not something that I pretend to have any expertise about.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Martin? Thank you, Mr. Martin. Representative Kahn?
Well, Mr. Chairman and members, I think my approach to this bill, the difficulty with my approach to this bill, was the fact that I never knew about any of these issues until I got involved in state government, and the state government requirements are so restrictive, and they seem to make so much sense to me. I mean, it's like, just think about when you're putting a mortgage on your house. The mortgage on your house is, a concrete piece of property. and the idea that we bonded for capital expenses just seemed to make so much sense. So my approach at the first time was when the city of Minneapolis started bonding for pensions few years ago, I went to Mr. Martin and said, can we draw up some bonds to deal, and I don't want to get into each of the pension funds. Each of the pension funds has a different problem. But I, under different circumstances, have drawn up two bills to deal with them that would remove or dramatically reduce the need to bond for pensions. And in both cases, the city of Minneapolis has refused to consider them. One of them, after they said, and I think that's why it might be best at this point to have the city of Minneapolis say why they're opposed to the bill. And as again, I've promised obviously that the second section will be just deleted because it's completely unnecessary. So I think the people that were concerned about the second section of the bill are no longer concerned about it. So I think if you have the city of Minneapolis tell why they're doing it, and then if there's still time, I do have someone who's worked with one of the pension funds to talk about the bills to talk about what the city of Minneapolis, the alternative procedures that the city of Minneapolis refused to use. So I think that's the best use of the time, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Kahn. Is it Patrick Bourne? Is that correct?
Yes.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Bourne. State your name for the record, please, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Pat Bourne. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the City of Minneapolis. Thank you for hearing my testimony today. Minneapolis does oppose this bill. We are one of only two local governments in Minnesota, we think, to have issued general obligation bonds to finance some of our pension obligations. However, nationwide, there are a number of state and local governments that have issued bonds to finance pension obligations. Minneapolis, though, is in a very unusual position. State law compels us to make contributions to each of our three closed pension funds. These are pension funds that have been closed to new employees since around 1980. State law imposes on Minneapolis certain financial obligations which we are living up to and which we intend to continue to live up to. Under the formulas in state law that specify what our annual contributions are, those contributions have gone up by an alarming rate. In 1999, for example, our contributions to these three funds was $12 million. Our contributions, by the way, are not to pay annual benefit payments to these employee groups. Our contributions are intended to get these funds fully funded by certain dates that are set forth in state law. And by the way, state aids are also used for the same purpose, but state aids are also done by formula and in certain cases specified revenue sources, and they are a more fixed variety. Our contributions, though, are intended to get these funds fully funded by certain dates. So with a drop in the stock market and the dates by which these funds have to be fully funded, our contributions have skyrocketed. Let me give you a few numbers. Again, in 1999, our contributions to these funds were about $12 million. By 2003, our contributions had risen to $54 million. In 2004, it had dropped to $42 million, but in 2005, it will be $44 million, and we estimate them to be $70 million in 2006. Believe me, if we could have found another way of financing our contributions other than by issuing bonds, we would have found it, and we are certainly using all forms of surplus cash to reduce our contributions that are being financed with bonds. I might add, just to put a little perspective on this, for every 1% increase in property taxes in Minneapolis, that produces about $1.5 million of property tax revenue. So you can see that the enormity of the increase from 1999 to the present day has been so large that we face only the ability to use bonds to finance these very large increase in contributions. Just to put a little more perspective on this, if we were to go to our voters and the voters would not agree to issue bonds for these pension payments, just in 2006, we would face a property tax increase of 25%, or about $200 per homeowner, simply in 2006. And the other way to approach this, of course, would be to cut expenses in our operating budget and maintain what would otherwise be our natural growth in property taxes. And we would have to cut our general fund tax-supported expenses by roughly $35 million. And if your local governments are like our city, the predominance of property taxes in our general fund are used for public safety purposes. Public safety represents more than 50% of the property tax expenditures in our general fund, and proportionally we would face a very, very large reduction over and above the reductions we're already facing in public safety. So because of the numbers of the increase in these contributions that are required by state law, we have resorted to issuing bonds to better manage the growth in our property tax and better manage the growth in these expenditures. Believe me, the city does not desire to issue bonds for this purpose. We seek other ways to reduce our contributions, and in fact, we will be sponsoring bills in this session to do just that. I think we won't perhaps get into that in this committee, but I would urge the committee's consideration on this matter, especially the matter of asking voters to approve pension bills. This is not a discretionary decision on the part of the city. This is a mandatory decision on our part to make these contributions, where the city voters, if asked, if they would fail to approve this, we would be forced to either make further expenditure cuts or make substantial tax increases as a result. Be happy to answer questions.
Mr. Bourne, I understand this is for three closed pension plans that the bonding occurs, and as I read your material here, I understand that the reason why the financial contribution has increased is there's been a lot of retirements. What is the prognosis, if you will? At what point will you be assured of not having such an increase in financial needs for these funds? Given that they're closed, and nobody else can enter them, I would think that at some point you must know that there's going to be a decline in funding needs. At what point would that be?
Sure. Mr. Chair, we do, in working with each of these three funds, forecast out what their needs are going to be, and we make as good an estimate as we can of what they are going to be. Some of those estimates are based on and are driven by the number of people retiring. And some of them, in fact, some of our contributions don't have anything to do with that. They have to do with the relative level of funding in those funds. One of our funds, the largest of our funds, the Minneapolis Employees Retirement Fund, the number of people left to retire there is a major contributing factor to what our contributions are to that particular fund. And there are about 400 or 500 of our employees who have yet to retire and who we think will retire over the next 5 to 7 years. We expect most of the eligible employees to retire over that period. The police and fire funds, however, our arrangement and our responsibility to those funds is different. our responsibility there is to see that they are fully funded by certain dates. The police fund, which has a very small number of people yet to retire, less than 25, our responsibility there is to see that that fund, together with other monies that the fund receives, is fully funded by 2010. So our day of getting that fund fully funded is approaching very rapidly. And so our contributions to that fund are quite large, almost $25 million in 2005. The fire fund, which is the smallest of these three funds, again has less than 50 folks who are current employees who are yet to retire. But again, our responsibility there is to see that that fund is fully funded within 15 years. And that fund has an unfunded liability of about $50 or $60 million, and our contributions together with state aids will eliminate that unfunded liability over that period. We have this unfunded liability factor that drives our contributions to both the police and fire funds. It really has nothing to do with how many people have yet to retire, like it does with the Minneapolis Employees Retirement Fund.
Thank you, Mr. Bourne. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much, Mr. Bourne, for your testimony. Mentions in this editorial that Representative Kahn referenced, it mentions that there's a blue ribbon committee that's already working on this issue, and it references, I think, or it doesn't quote you directly, but references, you know, that you had suggested some structural changes that this commission is looking at that could address this problem. Are there a couple that you're maybe at liberty to share with us if this issue is already being addressed you know, by some experts? Maybe it would alleviate the need for this legislation.
Mr. Bourne.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, the city did commission a blue ribbon panel of citizens of Minneapolis predominantly, but primarily business and civic leaders, including two former commissioners of finance, who spent about 4 months last summer and fall looking at our pension situation, made a number of recommendations, including some basic principles by which any reform plans ought to be considered. But their predominant recommendation was to merge all three of these funds into the Public Employees Retirement Association over some period of time. We're still considering, City Council, Mayor are still considering that recommendation, but and haven't either acted on it completely or not. The city, though, does agree with the Minneapolis Employees Retirement Fund that is sponsoring a bill that will be in front of this session that will make some changes that will cause our contribution rate to that fund to decline significantly, but still get that fund fully funded by its intended amortization date, the date by which it's fully funded, 2020. Our negotiations internally with the other two funds have not been successful, the Police and Fire Fund. We still hope that they will be. Our preference is to not fight in front of all of you, but to try to iron out our differences on the other side of the river and then come back with solutions. We hope that that will prevail. Our goal, in part, with all of these reform measures is to not only reduce our contribution levels to more manageable levels for us, but to maintain benefit levels to these employees and to more fairly balance the interests of both the taxpayers and the beneficiaries of these funds. Over time, there have been some governance issues that this Blue Ribbon panel has identified as being issues that are in need of reform, any reform measures that we can agree on, I think, will contain some governance changes that are intended to better balance the interests of both the taxpayers and the retirees. I might add that the state auditor in her staff's most recent audit report raises this very issue, which the Blue Ribbon Commission carefully examined and considered and agreed with. And you can imagine it's going to be very difficult to reach some kind of agreement among the city and these pension funds over governance issues, which are, frankly, need to be dealt with in state law. They are not of an administrative nature. They are of state law. They are a change that, will be required by state law.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none, Representative Khan, do you have any other comments? Thank you, Mr. Bourne.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I do have. First of all, from my experience in government, the first thing that you learn is anytime you call something a blue ribbon committee, you know that it's not going to come out with anything that's useful at all, because otherwise you wouldn't have to say it's a blue ribbon committee. You just let its work award it the blue ribbon. I would like to take just a few minutes remaining to have Ms. And there are many points I can put out about the problems of merger with PERA, which ought to make everyone in the state quite nervous about how that can be done, besides with people in Minneapolis. I'll give you, so there are actions of the city council that brought on the MRF problem. Again, I don't want to go into it this time. I'd just like to very quickly, in the last few minutes remaining, have Mr. Brian Rice talk about the plan that we had for the police fund, which was then rejected by the city. And he can just then say a few words.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Rice.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. My name is Brian Rice, and I'm here today as the General Counsel for the Minneapolis Police Relief Association. And Representative Khan was kind enough to ask me to come and testify against her bill. I want to make that clear that I would agree with Mr. Martin that for a pension fund, the choice of getting money or not getting money is pretty easy. You want the money. And Representative Khan actually introduced this bill 2 years ago in a response to her concern about how the city was handling it. And at that time, we told Representative Khan that, with all due respect, we need to meet these obligations. We also, at the same time, worked with Ron Abrams, Dan McElroy, and it's now clear that these pension obligations are exempt from any levy limits. So if the city needs to get the money for the pension fund, they can. They don't have to go to the voters, don't have to issue bonds. They would have to raise taxes. Tax is obviously a big concern. But last year, again, my good friend Representative Khan, in kind of response to her bill that you know before, we came up with an alternative.
Now, he's paying me back, because when I introduced this bill, I started saying, I don't really like this bill at all. It's just only better than bonding for pensions. So it's the payback.
That's the payback. And the issue was a way to reduce these contributions by the city. Currently, this year, the city in Minneapolis will be paying the police pension fund, my client, $25 million. Last year, with Representative Khan's bill and with the vote of this body of about 119 to 12, we passed a bill that would have reduced the city's contribution from $25 million to $9 million, a $16 million reduction in the city's obligation. The city council rejected that bill on a vote of 5-8 and said they didn't want to pay, they wanted to pay more to the pension fund rather than less. Now, you're probably going to want to hear from the city on why they did that. They had their reasons. The structure of the bill that we did essentially was to extend the funding date for the Minneapolis Police Pension Fund by 10 years. In essence, instead of having the city borrow money, go out to Wall Street and issue bonds, we basically said the pension fund will bond for it. We'll extend the mortgage. We'll lower your payments. You'll have to pay longer. The state very generously offered to pay about $30 to $40 million of the city's pension costs, because when you extended the funding 10 years, the state, in essence, said, we'll keep helping the city pay these obligations over the 10 years, but the city council chose not to adopt that. One part of the reason that they cited was that there was a small benefit improvement to retirees, about 2% a year, to retired police officers and surviving spouses. There was a reason for that, because by extending the funding date, you slowed down the rate at which assets accumulated in the fund. Fewer assets in the fund means smaller long-term benefit payments to the members. And the fund trustees' director simply said just extending the funding deadline would have an adverse effect on members' benefits, which the fund directors felt they couldn't do entirely. They did find, though, we in essence came up with a way to self-fund by the pension fund by extending the date to 2020, which would mirror what PRA's funding date is and all the other major pension funds. It would have given the city an option to reduce their pension costs significantly from $25 million to $9 million. And the city does have a problem. The directors of the pension fund recognize they have a fiduciary duty to not only the members, but to the state and the city, and they came up with a proposal that Representative Kahn carried, which we thought made an awful lot of sense on all parties concerned, but the city rejected it. The city does face some problems, but just so this committee knows, Mr. Bourne cited a funding of 12 or so million dollars in 1999. The city was paying as much as $30 million a year to these pension funds in the early 90s. Like some other cities, New York City did the same thing. When the stock market went up, a lot of employers kept their contributions because the market gave them huge returns. Now the exact opposite has happened. New York City, some other states are finding out when the good times were there, late 90s, early 2000, they could save a lot of money. They stopped contributing. Now they're finding out the market's turned, and you got to come back and pay the piper. And so now there's a crisis. Well, I would respectfully submit the city can't have it both ways. There was a period in time when they were adding police, adding a lot of services, in part because the stock market went up, their contributions went down, and it was a great time then. Now the city's concerned that, oh my God, we're facing all these mounting obligations. But what they didn't tell you that they were able to cut contributions at a period. It is a complicated issue. I do want to be clear, the pension funds that I represent does not support Representative Kahn's bill. We did support a bill she had last year that was a solution to the problem that the fund directors and members and thought was a reasonable solution, and it was a solution I think just the legislative body thought was reasonable as well just a year ago.
Representative Kahn, nobody's called for questions. Representative Kahn, we're about out of time. Do you have any?
No, I have no more comments. I'll talk to you and to some members and get into your process again, however it works.
Okay, well, we're going to hold it over with the hearing request live.
Okay.
Members, thank you, Representative Kahn, and thank you, Mr. Rice.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members, for listening.
Members, thank you. I just want to acknowledge one thing. I know when we try to make a decision like we did today, we can't always spend that kind of time, and I want to emphasize that. If it doesn't work well, I'll have to make decisions and just leave it open for you to object. Mm-hmm. With that, let me add to the comment. We actually have made a decision to consider bills with statewide implication. And as I sat here and thought about that a little bit, I realized that I'm actually quite puzzled that we haven't historically been hearing bills that provide make changes to general TIF, that represent general TIF legislation, or because they have statewide implication. And I think what we're going to do is I'm going to talk to Mary Cummins about a process, so we don't even have to discuss it here. These bills could be put on the list, a separate list with the list we'll send you for prioritizing bills, and you can identify whether or not you agree or disagree whether or not we should hear the bill. And that'll be a simple thing. With that, this afternoon you'll be getting a list. It's ahead of schedule, but the timeline is such. We now have four bills with hearing requests. The timeline is such you'll be getting a notice this afternoon so that you can prioritize bills for next week. But we'll have to have that back tomorrow morning, mid-morning probably by 10 o'clock. Is that reasonable? Pardon? Yeah. So watch for that. Thank you, members.
Thank you.
If there's no objection, meeting adjourned. Thank you.